Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, April the 12th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers are today are Jim Hoffman and myself, Scott Splavik. Now here's Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Scott. And we start off this from Davenport, written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Council rejects agreements. Davenport City Council voted against ratifying employment agreements for the interim city administrator and interim city attorney during a chaotic meeting Wednesday night. The City Council voted unanimously to ratify Mallory Merritt's appointment as interim city administrator, but her employment agreement that laid out pay and expectations for the position failed to gain the required support to pass. Interim city attorney Brian Heyer's ratification and agreement was deleted altogether from the agenda in a 7-2 vote after a tense exchange between a council member, a staff attorney, and members of the audience led to the mayor calling for the council chambers to be cleared. Merritt had been serving as the interim city administrator since November 17th, the previous administrator Corey Spiegel's last day working in office. Mayor Mike Mattson named Merritt to the interim position, in addition to her chief financial officer job with an executive order he signed November 8th. Heyer was appointed interim corporation counsel by an executive order by the mayor at the staff at the start of the year. The previous city attorney, Tom Warner, said he was placed on administrative leave in late November, shortly before his retirement. Mattson, five council members, and then city attorney Tom Warner also signed a memorandum of understanding, setting expectations and pay for Merritt, also dated November 8th. The agreement kept her base salary of $174,000 and would award her a lump sum of $50,000 on the May 3rd payroll cycle for the additional duties. Merritt's memorandum did not come before council for a public vote in a meeting in 2023. It did appear on an agenda in March on the advice of outside legal counsel, according to City Council background documents, alongside ratification of Heyer's appointment as interim city attorney and approval of an agreement setting expectations and pay. Heyer's agreement would have kept his base salary at $123,700 and paid a lump sum bonus of $50,000 on the May 3rd payroll cycle. Heyer told the Quad City Times last week that he had previously advised that the City Council vote on his and Merritt's appointments in the fall, but there weren't enough meetings left to get everything done. Warner was the city attorney that signed Merritt's agreement. The council delayed a vote on the matters last month, and they reappeared this cycle. At-large Alderman Jasmine Newton said she voted against Merritt's agreement not because of her performance, but because of the process of how the agreement was brought before the council. Merritt's appointment did not come before the council in 2023, Newton said. I heard that there wasn't time for it. There was time in December of 2023 to ratify three settlements. A new council was seated in January 2024, consisting of five new alderpersons, myself included. Sometime in January 23rd, 2024, I was asked regarding Heyer's appointment. I did not sign. I raised concerns, and thankfully, my concerns were listened to, and then subsequently is when we received advice from outside legal counsel that these should be ratified. I do believe that things of this nature should always be done in the public. Unequivocally, no ands, ifs, or buts, should be done in public, should be done simultaneously. That is how government can be transparent and accountable to its people. Several members of the public urged the council to vote down Merritt and Hires agreements, questioning why Merritt's agreement was coming before council months after it was signed and questioning whether the work of Merritt and Hire warranted $50,000 bonuses. Aldermans Ben Jobkin, Kyle Gripp, Paul Reinerts, Marion McGinnis, and Rick Dunn voted for Merritt's agreement, and Aldermans Newton, Tim Dunn, Jade Burkholder, and Tim Kelly voted against. Alderman Michaud Lynch was absent. So the agreement was one short of the six required to pass. During the City Council discussion of Hire's appointment ratification and agreement, Kelly had a tense exchange with staff attorney Mallory Bagley, which led to an outburst by some members of the audience, and Mattson called to clear the council chambers. Most of the audience filed out of the chambers, and several aldermen did too, in solidarity of the public being kicked out of the chamber. Aldermen returned to the dais. Newton refused to participate in the meeting until Mattson called the public back into the council chambers. Mattson did so, and people filed back in. Kelly motioned to delete Hire's ratification and agreement from the agenda, and the council, without discussion, voted 7-2 to delete. McGinnis and Gripp opposed the deletion. Burkholder, the new fourth ward representative on the council, told a reporter after the meeting she voted against both agreements because she thought the agreements should have come before council right away for a vote. "Ratifying doesn't sit well with me," Burkholder said. Newton said, in addition to her concerns about transparency, said she opposed a clause of both Merritt and Hire's memorandums that required unanimous approval from the four council committee chairs, the mayor and mayor pro tem, to terminate their employment as interims. Newton said removal of a permanent city administrator requires 2/3 vote of the council, and said although the law is silent on appointment or removal of interims, she thought the city should follow the same process. Gripp said he voted in support of Merritt and Hire's agreements because he believes they're doing an excellent job in the interim, and continuing will be the best way to move the city forward until permanent successors can be chosen. Especially in Merritt's case, Gripp said she's been operating under the agreement and has held up her end of the bargain. Reinerts said the disruption of the council meetings makes it difficult to come to decisions on the dais. He said he voted for Hire's item deletion because of the chaos of the moment. It was not immediately clear Wednesday night what next steps are for Hire and Merritt's interim appointments or the pay and expectations for those positions.
Thank you, Jim. Next article is entitled Construction Set to Begin. Work on $8.7 million downtown Rock Island project starts next week. It's written by Grace Kinnicutt of the Quad City Times. Construction for the $8.7 million project bringing large changes to downtown Rock Island is set to begin next week. Government officials and Valley Construction, which was awarded the nearly $9 million bid, planned to break ground on Monday, April the 16th. I think that's a misprint. Isn't Monday the 15th? Upgrades and improvements to downtown include reconstruction of downtown streets, removal of the Second Avenue pedestrian mall, installation of a roundabout, adding outdoor seating and signage, renovating Arts Alley, new lighting, Rock Island signage, wider sidewalks for outdoor dining, and more. Project members and city officials discussed the construction timeline at a Wednesday public meeting at the Stern Center in downtown Rock Island. Jack Cullen, Rock Island Downtown Alliance Executive Director, said four blocks will be demolished and reconstructed, and Arts Alley will undergo a full renovation. The project is broken into three phases, he said. This is the largest investment into downtown in more than a generation, Cullen said. Phase one, which begins Monday, focuses on 18th Street from 1st Avenue to 3rd Avenue, 3rd Avenue from 18th Street to 19th Street, and 2nd Avenue from 18th Street to 19th Street. The first phase is expected to be completed by the end of this year. Construction also is weather dependent, Aaron Lubitz of Valley Construction said. We will be tearing up the downtown area, Lubitz said. Downtown business and property owners and residents brought up a few concerns regarding street closures, available parking, and water and sewer impacts. Jason McKenzie, senior project manager at Veenstra and Kim, said many lines of communication will be open to alert downtown stakeholders and residents, including door hangers, on-site personnel, newsletters, emails, and the city website and social media. Biweekly newsletters, he said, will include what phase of construction the project is in and what is happening in the project at the moment and the plan for the next 2 weeks of construction. Once a month, meetings will be held to go over progress and the updated construction schedule, McKenzie said. The first phase is the largest section of downtown reconstruction. Roads will be closed to all traffic as they will be torn up and replaced, McKenzie said. 5 feet of sidewalk is to remain open for businesses while the road is closed. Once the road is finished, it will reopen and then the sidewalk will be closed so it can be reconstructed, he said. Road closures and detours will be communicated and signage will be in place. Downtown construction also will include new water and sewer lines. The current water and sewer lines will remain connected as the new ones are being constructed. When it comes time to connect the new lines, he said, businesses will be alerted. Lubitz emphasized they will alert businesses and residents 48 to 72 hours ahead of time and that they are willing to work with businesses to find a time that would minimize the impact of the disruption. Communication will be ongoing for water and sewer lines, and if a boil order will need to go into effect. Valley Construction is working with the city to keep parking impacts to a minimum, Lubitz said. Parking will be available at city-owned lots and on the side of the streets that are not closed due to construction. Cullen said they are working with Modern Woodmen to potentially lease two of their lots. The potential future lots are at 1st Avenue and 17th Street and at the southeast corner of 2nd Avenue and 20th Street intersection. There will be about a loss of 20 spots, Cullen said. Phase 2 is scheduled to begin in October of 2024 and will be at the intersections of 2nd Avenue and 19th Street and 3rd Avenue and 19th Street. It is expected to be completed by the end of December 2024. Phase 3 is the reconstruction of Arts Alley and will be going on while phases 1 and 2 are happening. It is expected to begin in June and finish by August. Funding sources for the multi-million dollar downtown project includes $1.5 million from downtown tax increment financing funds, $3.9 million from ARPA, and $3 million State of Illinois Rebuild Downtown grant. There also is a contingency of 5% or $467,000. Cullen said the Downtown Alliance is working with the city to explore possible funding to help impacted businesses during construction. Possible funding will be communicated to downtown stakeholders, he said. Mayor Mike Thomas said this is one of the biggest investments to downtown and looks forward to the end result and how this will help move Rock Island into a new direction. The construction will be a bit of a pain, Thomas said, but the end result will be amazing.
Thanks, Scott. And we'll continue with an article, a Timeless Tickets article, written by Gannon Hannevold of the Quad City Times. Palmer went punk in 1984 with The Clash. The punk rock movement of the 1970s was already hitting a tailspin by 1984. It had been 5 years since Sid Vicious died and the Sex Pistols broke up. The Clash were splintering too, saying goodbye to two of its founding members in 82 and 83. New subgenres of punk were starting to pop up more consistently. There was hardcore music rising from the West Coast and a new wave coming from overseas. But while it wasn't quite the authoritarian 1984 that George Orwell wrote about, there was still plenty to be riled up about. So much so that The Clash, when they came to Davenport on May 20th, 1984, sold all 2,600 tickets almost instantly. By the time the concert rolled around, The Clash were 2 years removed from Combat Rock, an album that went on twice certified platinum by the RIAA in the United States, a level of success arguably anti-ethical to the punk rock spirit. In the summer of 1983, The Clash were still playing festivals with over $100,000 in attendance. And in 1982, their biggest mainstream single, Rock the Casbah, was in the top 10 on the Billboard charts. It was a raucous scene at Palmer Auditorium in 1984. There was little doubt that the band of five musicians was different than any other that has ever played in the Quad Cities, wrote Quad City Times reviewer Jim Rinks. Rinks described the scene, and it was as abrasive as the band's ska adjacent rock music had always been. There were even video monitors behind the band playing movie clips from Magnum Force and the Warriors, interspersed with archival news footage from Nazi Germany. The Clash tickets sold for just $12.50, a cheap number, especially considering the band was robbed of $17,000 at a show in East Lansing, Michigan just a week before their Davenport date. In a column ahead of the show, Rinks took aim at Quad City music fans who chose to spurn The Clash by instead going westward to the Des Moines Metal Festival Iowa Jam, headed by Ozzy Osbourne, Motley Crue, and Ted Nugent. I can't believe that people will travel all over the state to hear the same party till you puke theme repeated over and over, he wrote. And yet they won't go to see a band that is noted by Rolling Stone and nearly every other rock authority as one of the most important and influential bands since the Beatles. At one point in the middle of The Clash's show, lead singer Joe Strummer leaned into the semi-rivalry with the fest in Des Moines. He asked the crowd whether or not they knew the difference between The Clash and Motley Crue. They certainly did. The fans weren't all mohawked. Some wore black and some were preppy, as Rinks described it, but all of them had fists in the air. Punk rock may have been at an inflection point, but it was still alive and well. Just 3 days before The Clash played at Palmer, there was a show headlined by Huey Lewis in the News, a rock group who was just starting to hit their stride. Huey and company were in town a month before the release of Sports, the band's breakout record, which charted four songs in the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. It was also one of five records to hold the number one spot on the Billboard album chart in 1984, joining Footloose, Thriller, Purple Rain, and Born in the USA. And while many of the News' sprightly and straightforward rock songs may have sounded right at home on the mainstream charts, not all of their peers did. The culprit was assumed to be MTV, whose 24-hour music video broadcast poured gas on the already lit fame of countercultural music consumption. In his recurring entertainment column, Inside Track, Rink spoke with music directors at local radio stations, who told him that alternative genres were indeed starting to get their time in the sun. I don't think you would have heard a group like Duran Duran on this station if it hadn't been for MTV, one told him. Rinks also used his entertainment column to briefly eulogize singer Marvin Gaye, who was shot and killed in Los Angeles just a month before the Clash concert. Like many punk bands, Gaye was no stranger to injecting sharp opinions into his lyrics. His 1971 soul record, What's Going On, defied norms by being explicitly political and still commercially successful. On it, Gaye took on topics of environmentalism, racism, and police brutality, but the record still finished sixth on the U.S. Billboard pop charts. All this to say, music had already been a medium for expressing radical political views. But the Clash's show in Davenport proved that in 1984, despite the general conservative cultural shift happening amid Reagan's first term, punk hadn't lost their punch.
From the local page, Eldridge Man Arrested for Robbery. This is written by Anthony Watt. A man suspected of robbing a Moline tobacco store has been arrested in Iowa. The robbery happened around noon on Tuesday at Greenleaf Tobacco and Vape, 3824 44th Avenue Drive, according to the Moline Police Department. The male robber entered the store, stole merchandise, and threatened an employee, a police media release said. Moline police officers and Scott County Sheriff's Office deputies arrested Donovan D. Cannon, age 29, of Eldridge in Parkview, according to the police department. The officers and deputies have recovered a pellet gun and other evidence. An initial photo of the suspect that was released by the police department showed a man with shoulder-length hair. Scott County Jail's photo of Cannon shows him with his head shaved. Moline police said investigators recovered shaved braids of hair as part of the robbery investigation. No one was hurt in Tuesday's robbery, but the robber threatened to shoot an employee, according to the police. As of Wednesday afternoon, Cannon remained in custody at Scott County Jail pending extradition to Illinois, according to the department and the jail's website. Authorities were holding him on suspicion of aggravated robbery and theft, according to Moline Police. And St. Ambrose presents McMullen Awards. This is written by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. St. Ambrose University presented its annual McMullen Awards during a Mass at Christ the King Chapel on Thursday. This year's recipients are Edmund and Molly Carroll and Stephen and Shelley Rowell. Named in honor of SAU founder Reverend John J. McMullen, the McMullen Award honors servant leadership and individuals who embody the university's mission, an inclusive Catholic and diocesan community of learners. SAU empowers all Ambrosians to act courageously, to seek wisdom through faith and reason, to work for justice, and to lead lives of service. Ed and Molly Carroll personify the concept of serving in, with, and for our community, an SAU media release said. Ed received his bachelor's degree in history from Georgetown University and was a three-year football starter. He earned his Juris Doctor from Marquette University Law School and joined Lane and Waterman in 1986, specializing in corporate and transactional law. Molly has a bachelor's degree from the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana's College of Commerce. She began a long career in the newspaper industry post-graduation, working at the Chicago Tribune and Lee Enterprises as a publisher of the Muscatine Journal. In 2008, Ed joined the SAU Board of Trustees and chaired the Nominating and Governance Committee. He also held positions for YMCA of the Iowa-Mississippi Valley and the Genesis Health Services Foundation. To Ed, a highlight of his many years of service was leading an Italian pilgrimage with Senior Joan Lisensky, exploring St. Ambrose of Milan, SAU's patron saint. Molly's volunteerism, primarily focused on youth and education, notably working with Project Renewal and United Way Quad Cities Women United Initiative. In the past, she chaired United Way QC's Women's Leadership Council. The couple also helped lead what became SAU's annual wine festival, a multi-event fundraiser expected to surpass $2 million total while they have chaired it. Individually, Steve and Sheila Rowell have made significant contributions through their careers in community involvement, SAU said in the release. Together as a couple, the ripple effect of their service has impacted thousands, states the SAU release. Steve, a 1971 SAU grad, credits former SAU professor Wally Evans for making a difference in his life, citing Evans's mentorship and influence during and after undergraduate studies. After graduating from SAU, his career started as a public accountant at Arthur Young & Company in Chicago. Steve later joined Johnson Controls in 1982 as an operations controller, retiring in 2013 as CEO and chairman of the board of directors. Also in 2013, he founded the Johnson Controls Innovation Center with a vision to continually transform the company. Upon Steve's retirement, Johnson Controls renamed its global center the Stephen A. Rowell Initiative, or excuse me, Innovation Center. A retired clinical psychologist and registered nurse, Dr. Sheila Rowell wore many hats throughout her career, including psychological evaluation and treatment, research, and teaching. She was also an accomplished equestrian, per the release, eventually merging her passions and educational background to work with organizations that utilize horses to provide physical, emotional, and social benefits to participants of all ages. The couple have continued to invest in SAU, with Steve co-chairing the McMullen Hall Capital Initiative. St. Ambrose provided me with the education, encouragement, character, and values to be successful in my business career, he said in the release. Jim?
Thanks, God. We've got a couple minutes before we get to obituaries, and here's an interesting article written by Laura Yeater, Donuts, Coffee, and Italian Among Specials. Here's a look at five specials for Friday during Quad Cities Restaurant Week in the Quad Cities. From April 8th to April 14th, more than 100 local restaurants will be part of the 12th annual promotion hosted by Local Tourism and Economic Development Organization, Visit Quad Cities. So, Laura tells us here for breakfast at Donuts and More, the special is you buy one half dozen and get one free. Dine-in only. Does not include breakfast sandwiches, drinks, or fancies. For lunch, she suggests Johnny's Italian Steakhouse. And for specials, you can choose between the following for $14 a person. Johnny's Chicken de Burgo with garlic mashed potatoes. The Johnny, which is a chicken Caesar sandwich with fries. Four cheese ravioli with cup of soup. Their hours are Sunday to Thursday, 11 to 9 p.m. and Friday to Saturday, 11 to 10. For dinner, there's Azteca Mexican Restaurant, and the special is you buy one, get one for your next visit in every to-go order above $25. And jumbo margaritas are $7 all week long. Bar and grill, she suggests try the River House. They're special. Every margarita will come with a small basket of homemade chips and garlic dip. And then finally, for dessert at Sugar a la Mode, get a free cup of coffee with any purchase over $5. And they specialize in cheesecakes, macaroons, scones, and decorated cookies.
Too bad we're not in the Quad Cities. That sounds pretty good. Now it's time for today's obituaries. And our first obituary is Kathleen Kathy Thompson, age 67, of LeClaire, Iowa, who passed away at home on April the 8th, 2024. Per her wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. A celebration of Kathy's life will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, April the 12th, 2024, at Lake Davenport Sailing Club. In her memory, contributions may be made to a charity of your choice. Online condolences and fond memories may be expressed at www.weertsfh.com. That's weertsfh.com. Kathy was born on March the 16th, 1957, in Davenport to parents Beverly and Richard McMahon. She graduated from Hazen High School in Washington and went on to build her own small business. Kathy was the owner of Thompson Brush Company, which she started in 1985 and retired from in 2010. Kathy married Dan Thompson, and together they had a beloved daughter named Catherine. Kathy and Dan later parted ways. In 2001, she met Bruce Byram at Lake Davenport Sailing Club, and they fell in love. Their families converged, and they had over 22 years in each other's company. Being a woman of many talents, we can't possibly list all the ways in which Kathy spent her time and brightened our lives. Just some of her passions include floral gardening, cooking, creating stained glass art, camping, fishing, and scuba diving. Kathy was the embodiment of a loving spirit. She accepted and loved everyone and would always offer a helping hand or sage advice. Kathy held a special place in her heart for golden retrievers. Her most cherished dog was named Austin. Those left to carry on her love include her significant other, Bruce Byram, daughter Katie, siblings Connie Peters, Susan Lutz, Scott McMahon, Daniel McMahon, and many nieces and nephews. And George Clive Statler, age 84, of Des Moines, transitioned to glory on Tuesday, April the 2nd, 2024, at Ramsey Village in Des Moines, surrounded by his family. Funeral services will be held 2 p.m. Saturday, April the 13th, 2024, at the Jones and Eden Funeral Home in Washington, Iowa, with Carl Roberts officiating. Calling hours will begin at 12 p.m. Saturday, April the 13th, at the Jones and Eden Funeral Home, where the family will be present to receive friends from 12 p.m. until 2 p.m. Interment will take place at the Elm Grove Cemetery in Washington. Memorials have been established for Boys Town. Online condolences may be sent for Clive's family at www.jonesfh.com. Clive was born November the 26th, 1939, in Brighton, Iowa, the son of George William and Vera Jeanette Statler. He attended school in Anchorage, Alaska, and Brighton, Iowa, where he graduated from Brighton High School. Clive was united in marriage to Shirley May Goodwin on November the 1st, 1959, in Washington, Iowa. Clive worked as a mill worker for Alcoa Aluminum in Bettendorf for 36 years. Following his retirement, he and Shirley returned to Washington for several years before moving to Ankeny to be near family, then on to Ramsey Village in Des Moines. Clive and Shirley were members of Bettendorf Christian Church, where he served as a deacon. Clive was a lifetime member of Alcoa Aluminum Workers of America. He enjoyed being with his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, spending time outdoors, fishing, camping, bicycle riding, and taking long, relaxing walks. He was a lifetime member of Nautilus, where he loved to work out, and at the YMCA in Washington and Ankeny. He was a blood donor, donating over 20 gallons, and a supporter of Boys Town. He's survived by his wife, Shirley, daughter, Brenda Sequoy of Vine Grove, Kentucky, son, Denny Statler, and son, Doug Statler, all of Ankeny, 13 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren. Jim?
We have several pending funerals. We have Leon Albrecht, 80, of Port Byron, Illinois. Calvin Ray Bradbury, 55, of Galesburg. Gary Trenard, 87, of Moline. Ryan C. Corzine, 48, of Iowa City. Thomas Anthony Fidel, 86, of Maquoketa. Joseph Flynn, 67, of DeWitt. Christine French, 74, of Davenport. Daniel R. Held, 65, of Moline. Sharon Krabs Hickenbottom, 81, of Davenport. Michael W. Malmstrom, 71, of Moline. And Carla Marshall, 63, of Davenport. So this ends the obituaries. We move to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. We have this written by Tom Martin, the executive editor of the Quad City Times. Building collapse coverage earns award in Illinois. The newsroom has earned 9 awards in the 2023 Illinois Press Association contest. The contest judges stories and photos published in 2023. The Dispatch Argus actually qualifies as a small daily in the contest, but we asked to be bumped to the mid-sized daily division this year because our newsroom also serves the Quad City Times, and plus we wanted to compete against bigger newsrooms. The Illinois Press Association announced the winning entries this week. We'll find out the convention at the convention June 6th in Bloomington whether the entries are first, second, or third placed. The Davenport building collapse coverage, which earned first place in the Iowa Newspaper Association, placed in the Illinois contest as well. Nearly the entire staff contributed to that coverage. Here are the entries that have placed. For news reporting series, the staff, building collapse in Davenport kills 3. Story series, agricultural story, Gretchen Teske, rising food costs, not just in homes. The photo series, Roy Dabner, geese at Vanderveer Park. A local editorial category, Tom Martin, Dispatch Argus editorials. Government beat reporting, Sarah Watson, coverage of the city of Davenport. The obituary tribute, Tom Lowy, many miss Hard Hat Man. Editorial page, Tom Martin, Dispatch Argus, editorial pages. The best website, Connor Wood, Dispatch Argus website, qconline.com. Freedom of Information Award, Tom Martin, editorials urging transparency of city government. Last year, in the small division, we earned 11 awards, so 9 awards against larger newspapers is progress. I'm grateful to see our best work recognized. Wild weekend at NCAA Final Four. What a weekend it was, with the Iowa women's basketball team advancing in the Final Four with a win over the University of Connecticut in a nail-biter, and now we all are experts on moving screens. The Hawkeyes unfortunately fell short against a juggernaut South Carolina team in the championship. The Quad City Times nailed a 3-pointer from the logo by sending Gretchen Teske to cover the Final Four. Not long after we made arrangements to send Gretchen, our business reporter, I learned of Gretchen's love of women's basketball from an early age. If you missed Gretchen's column on the subject, I highly recommend it. Gretchen Teske at Final Four, the 8-year-old basketball star, waited her whole life for this. Gretchen worked tirelessly to provide constant updates for a blog multimedia editor Grace Kennicott kept up through the weekend. Along with that, Gretchen wrote 6 stories talking to a variety of fervent Hawkeye fans and describing the scenes in Cleveland from the bars to the court. Gretchen's perspective was perfectly matched with this moment in women's college basketball. And then Tom writes, Timeless Tickets is back, this time revisiting the 80s. Entertainment reporter Gannon Hannibal resumed his Timeless Tickets series on Monday. Gannon will name the most notable concert festival in the Quad Cities for each year during the 1980s. The series aims to do this for every year from 1960 to today, a huge undertaking. We've already run the concerts for each year of the 1960s and 70s. Here's what Gannon's done so far this week. 1980, Harry Chapin plays through a power outage at Palmer Auditorium in 1980. 1981, Ozzy Osbourne brings the Crazy Train to Davenport. 1982, Prince played at Palmer in 82, visited Moline Hospital before death. 1983, Willie Nelson received then record pay for performance at Quad Cities at the fair. My sources tell me 1984 will be about The Clash, which we read earlier, performing in the Quad Cities. The Timeless Tickets for the 1980s will wrap up April 15th. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Jim. And another opinion piece from the Chicago Tribune, GOP right to call out failings of Prisoner Review Board. The horrifying case of Crosetti Brand has surfaced an issue that's been percolating in Springfield for 4 years, the performance of the Illinois Prisoner Review Board. The state body, comprising up to 15 members and by law required to include representatives of both parties, is responsible, among other things, for the critical job of deciding whether and when criminals should be paroled. It was the Prisoner Review Board that ruled last month it couldn't continue to hold Brand when he clearly committed acts that should have been deemed parole violations and should have returned him to prison. Brand was initially paroled late last year after serving 8 years of a 16-year sentence for home invasion and aggravated battery involving an ex-girlfriend. After the board decided it lacked evidence to continue holding him despite his threats early this year to a different woman he had dated more than a decade before, he was released and the following day attacked her, according to police and prosecutors. Her 11-year-old son, Jaden Perkins, was killed on March 13th trying to defend his 33-year-old pregnant mother, who was badly injured but survived. Governor J.B. Pritzker reacted by accepting the resignations of the Prisoner Review Board member who heard Brand's case and the board's chairman. Those were proper steps to take, but the issue of the board and how it's operated under Pritzker is far from settled. Senate Republicans, who sounded the alarm for years on questionable parole decisions, well before the Crosetti Brand fiasco, now are proposing wide-ranging legislation to reform the board and to increase penalties for violations of orders of protection in domestic situations. Among other things, the bill would require more stringent qualifications for board members who are paid nearly $100,000 a year. We have been raising red flags, State Senator Jason Plummer, a Republican from Edwardsville, said Tuesday at a news conference to unveil the bill. We have been warning about the lack of qualifications of some of the governor's appointees for years. Literally years. I don't know why it's taken a dead child for people to recognize some of these people are not qualified to serve on the board. Plummer, the top Senate Republican on the Executive Appointments Committee, said the board under Pritzker has been more than twice as likely to parole convicts, including murderers, than the past three governors, including two Democrats. Those paroles include some notorious examples, such as Chester Wegger, the so-called starved rock killer, convicted of the 1960 murder of three women out for a hike, who was released in 2020 at age 83. Another was the 2021 release of Johnny Veal, who, along with a second man, was convicted of killing two Chicago police officers in 1970. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox generally sympathetic to restorative justice and rehabilitation arguments, opposed Veal's parole, describing the cop killings as cold-blooded executions, and adding that Veal boasted about it. Yet another was Ray Larson, given a 100 to 300-year sentence for murdering a 16-year-old fishing in a forest preserve in 1972. The board moved to release him in 2021, and Larson immediately violated parole and was a fugitive for a week before authorities caught up with him at a local hospital. While Larson was unaccounted for, Fox's office warned surviving family members of Frank Casolari, Larson's victim, since Larson previously had threatened to harm family members, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. Under Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, the Prisoner Review Board voted 12-0 to deny Larson parole. Under Pritzker, the board granted Larson's release on a 9-3 vote. Republicans in Springfield often struggle to be heard, since Democrats enjoy overwhelming majorities in both legislative chambers. But they've been right to call out the governor on the failures of the Prisoner Review Board, and Democrats in the Capitol should have heeded their warnings far earlier. Like it or not, Pritzker bears part of the responsibility for the nightmare Jaden Perkins' family has endured. Many of his Prison Review Board appointees have reflected a philosophy emphasizing criminal rehabilitation over victims' concerns, and the board's decisions have followed suit. So what now? We hope it goes without saying that Democrats must engage honestly with Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Don Harmon, a Democrat from Oak Park, says he'll review the GOP proposal. Hopefully, that review won't be just cursory. If Republicans' proposal to require a minimum 20 years of consecutive experience in the criminal justice system isn't the right prescription, Democrats need to negotiate a set of qualifications to reassure the public that board members won't be more sympathetic to criminals than to victims. The Pritzker administration says it already either is doing what the GOP bill calls for or is responding to the Jaden Perkins tragedy with enhanced training around domestic violence for board members. While lawmakers begin the process of considering systemic changes, the governor himself needs to reassure Illinoisans that he's committed to a parole system that's fairer to victims and better accounts for the safety of the public than the one over which he's presided so far. Here's a good way to start. There currently are 11 members of the Prisoner Review Board following the two recent resignations. 4 seats are vacant. Pritzker would do well to quickly find 4 new appointees with solid public safety bona fides that garner Republican support. Bipartisan agreement around the handling of the issue, as sensitive as early release of violent criminals, is in the governor's ongoing political interest. It's good public policy as well.
Thanks, Scott. And we'll turn to sports. And there's a healthy amount of sports on television. Let me give you the schedule here. We have Australian rules men football today at 9:30, St. Kilda at Greater Western Sydney on FS2. At 1:30, we have Carlton versus Adelaide on FS1, and then at 4:30, Fremantle at Port Adelaide on FS2. In auto racing, you can watch the NASCAR Truck Series from Fort Worth on FS1 at 7:30. College baseball, we have 3 games, Minnesota at Michigan on the Big Ten Network at 7. LSU at Tennessee at 7 on ESPNU, and Mississippi State at Mississippi on the Southeast Conference Network at 7 o'clock. College softball, we have at 5 o'clock, Minnesota at Illinois on Big Ten Network, Arkansas at South Carolina, Southeast Conference Network. Then at 6 o'clock, North Carolina State at Virginia on ACC Network, Duke at Clemson on ESPN2, 7 o'clock, Oregon at Arizona on Pac-12 Network, and at 9 o'clock, California at UCLA on the Pac-12 Network. In golf, the PGA Masters is going to be covered on ESPN starting at 2 o'clock. Horse racing at noon today. The New York Racing Association, America's Day at the Races on FS2. Major League Baseball, we've got Cincinnati at Chicago White Sox on NBC Sports Channel at 6:40. Texas at Houston at 7 o'clock on Major League Baseball Network. 8:40, Chicago Cubs at Seattle on Apple TV Plus. And at 8:40 also, St. Louis at Arizona on BSMW. NBA, we have at 6 o'clock, Chicago at Washington on NBC Sports Channel. We have Milwaukee at Oklahoma City at 7 on NBA TV. And then at 9:30, Phoenix at Sacramento on NBA TV. National Hockey League at 7 o'clock, Carolina at St. Louis, a National Hockey League Network. And then at 7:30, Nashville at Chicago on the NBC Sports Channel. And in tennis, Friday and Saturday at 4 o'clock, the Monte Carlo quarterfinals on the Tennis Network. And at 5 o'clock, Billie Jean King Cup qualifier, U.S. versus Belgium on the Tennis Network. And finally, at 6 o'clock, Pro Volleyball Federation. We have San Diego at Columbus on the CBS Sports Network.
In some local sports news, Bettendorf North Scott claim wins. Jesse Day Relays brings 11 teams to town. This is written by Samir Mala of the Quad City Times. The Bettendorf boys and the North Scott girls won the 11-team Jesse Day Relay team titles Thursday night at Brady Street Stadium. Bettendorf won the 4,000-meter relay, the 3,200-meter relay, and three individual events, A.J. Wiley, 1,600, Billy Miller, 400 hurdles, and J.J. McDermott, 200, en route to 131.5 points. The Bulldogs quartet of Kaiser Riley, Hayden Morrison, Zach Van Wychen, and Willie finished 15 seconds ahead of second-place Clinton in the 4,000-meter relay. In the 3,200 relay, Bettendorf group of Gage Rath, Caleb Rankin, Liam Renberg, and Gage Tucker were 6 seconds faster than Muscatine, which finished in second place. Bettendorf brothers Billy and Carson Miller had first and second place results in the 400 hurdles. Billy, a sophomore, beat his older brother, a junior, 59.09 seconds to 59.17 seconds. North Scott's 108 points were 6 more than Mount Vernon for the girls' crown. Senior standout Sydney Skerich led the way for the Lancers, leaping 17 feet 2 inches to win the long jump. In the 200, Natalie Nowaczuk placed second, and Nazea Block of Davenport Central was placed second to Nazea Block of Davenport Central. The Lancers were second in four relays, the 400, 800, 400 shuttle, and 800 sprint medley, and 4,000 distance medley. In the 4x100, Parker Ward, Adeline Johnson, Georgia Brunken, and Harmony Hansel teamed for a time of 51.44 seconds behind Clinton's Quinn Nielsen, Hannah Molly, Amari Russell, and Kanija Angel's winning time of 51.44 seconds. For more on Thursday night's meet, you can go to qctimes.com. And Bandits Rained Out announce free day. Quad City River Bandits fans will have a free day at the ballpark later this month. In recognition of Modern Woodman Park being recognized as the nation's best minor league ballpark in USA Today's 10 Best 2024 Reader's Choice Awards, River Bandits officials announced on Thursday that a free admission day is planned for Sunday, April the 21st, when the Bandits host the Peoria Chiefs. Also planned are pre-game player autographs and kids running the bases after the game. Fans can pick up their free tickets for the 1 p.m. game at the Modern Woodman Park box office during regular business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. It's such a great honor for all of us at the River Bandits to be named the best minor league ballpark in America by USA Today's 10 Best, and we want to say thank you to everyone in this great community by opening the gates and letting everyone in free, River Bandits owner David Heller said. This year's honor marks Modern Woodman Park's second USA Today Best 10 Reader's Choice Award after the ballpark earned the distinction in the publication's last ranking in 2013. The accolade is just the latest for the historic venue. Main Street Baseball in 2007 has been named one of the nation's best by the likes of Bleacher Report, Ballpark Digest, and Parade Magazine. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to Irish programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.